Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
They're taking a big risk with the weather. That's out of their control. It's out of my control. It's out of their control. And you learn that, what you've heard over the years can hit you one summer.
If you've ever tried to grow your own food, you know what Phil Christensen is talking about. The weather hit Indiana gardeners in a big way this summer. We learn about the ripple effect from Phil harvesting next to nothing from his garden. From Harvest Public Media, the tricky business of determining what property taxes farmers should pay on their land. Judy Wicks built her restaurant around partnerships with local farmers, employees, and community members. Before that, the rise of fast casual. And recipes for Hanukkah with Daniel Orr. First up, a look at food news. Here's Mark Chilla.
Chipotle faces more bad news as 80 Boston college students have fallen ill after eating at a restaurant location close to campus. Last month, an E. coli outbreak in 9 states forced Chipotle to close restaurants in the Pacific Northwest and inspect restaurants in California, Minnesota, New York, and Ohio. Students involved in the most recent outbreak have been tested for E. coli and norovirus, the most common cause of gastrointestinal illness in the U.S. Chipotle released a statement saying they had closed the Boston-area Cleveland Circle store while the investigation is underway. They also pointed out that the E. coli outbreak in Boston has not been linked to the previous outbreak. The specific item or items that were contaminated have not been identified in this outbreak. Canada and Mexico are threatening to impose tariffs on more than $1 billion worth of U.S. goods. As Harvest Public Media's Jeremy Bernfeld reports, it's in retaliation for labels on meat at the grocery store.
Your beef, pork, and chicken has a little label on it that says where the animal it came from was born, raised, and slaughtered. And Canada and Mexico blame that little label for a drop in demand for their products. Veronica Nye is an economist with the American Farm Bureau Federation.
Because there's additional steps those international suppliers have to follow, they end up receiving a lower price for their product than the domestic counterpart.
That's why the World Trade Organization announced Monday that the two countries can start charging an import tax for U.S. goods. It's not clear what products could be hit by the tariffs, but Mexico and Canada are the U.S.'s second and third largest trading partners. Jeremy Bernfeld, Harvest Public Media.
And supermarkets made a pledge to increase their numbers in food deserts, but research is showing they are well below their 2016 target. As part of First Lady Michelle Obama's 2011 Partnership for a Healthier America, supermarkets vowed to increase their numbers in food deserts, opening 1,500 new stores by mid-2016. But of the over 10,000 new stores opened by the top 75 food retailers between 2011 and 2015, barely 250 new supermarkets were opened in those neighborhoods. Food deserts are defined as rural or urban areas where at least 20% of the residents live in poverty and 33% of the people live without a supermarket or large grocery store nearby. That's a store that offers fresh produce and meat. Supermarkets have argued that opening new stores in food deserts meets a host of challenges. Security and insurance cost more in areas perceived as presenting higher crime risks. Another explanation could be profit. Superstores typically open where there are other stores to compete against. With no competition in the area, it may not seem profitable to open a store. Supermarkets open at a deficit and must remain open for at least 10 years to become profitable.
Keep up on the top stories throughout the day. That's on our Twitter page. Connect with us at Earth Eats. That update courtesy of Mark Chilla.
Great. Till next time.
The value of farmland is riding high, and so are the taxes farmers pay on that property. But as those numbers remain steady, the actual income farmers make on the land has tumbled. That's got some farmers pushing for a discount on their tax bill. Harvest Public Media's Grant Gerlach reports.
Larry Tegler raises corn and soybeans along with some cattle in northeast Nebraska. He started farming about 30 years ago, and the field he's showing me was the first land he ever bought.
I bought this in 1987.
160 acres of rolling, sandy soil, an irrigation pivot at the top of the hill, two tall grain bins in the corner.
We were just coming out of the kind of a financial collapse here that we had in the early 80s, and in 87 I bought this quarter for $600 an acre.
A lot's changed since then, like what this farm is worth.
I would guess right now we would be in that $8,000 to $9,000 range.
$9,000 per acre, making it a million-dollar farm. That's the kind of wealth farmers who own land have built up as land values spiked over the last 10 years. And because it's worth more, they're also paying a lot more property taxes. Here in Madison County, Nebraska, where Tegeler farms, nearly $20 million in property taxes were collected from ag land last year. That's three times what farmland paid in 2004. Tegeler says it wasn't such a big deal when commodity prices were still high.
Well, yeah, you didn't hear anybody complaining too much, when we had $7 corn. And now we're having a tougher time paying for it.
Farm income has plummeted over the last couple years. Grain prices are break-even at best, and farm debt is on the rise. Even with government payments and crop insurance, some producers will struggle to turn a profit. John Anderson studies public finance at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln.
There's an asymmetry here, and people get upset because the values aren't falling as fast as they think they should.
Anderson says property taxes are important because they're the main source of funding for local services, like schools, police, and fire. Some states base property tax rates on soil type or income potential. Some go by rental rates or recent land sales. However they're calculated, the results are similar across the region. Property taxes are costing farmers, and in several states, powerful ag groups have been lobbying for cuts. But Anderson believes it's a reasonable source of funding.
Property owners with more property wealth have greater ability to pay, and we generally think that's a good principle of taxation, that those with greater ability should shoulder a larger share of the burden.
Farm-heavy states like Kansas and Illinois are facing big budget deficits. Cutting state revenue isn't likely in the cards. In Nebraska, legislators are looking at changes, but State Senator Kate Sullivan says relief for farmers would leave a big hole in school funding.
Where will that money come from? It's either going to have to be additional new sources of revenue, which quite frankly doesn't set well with a lot of people, or you simply take that revenue away from other programs that are currently being supported by state dollars.
Farmer Larry Tegeler isn't looking to slash school budgets, but he says farmers are just bearing too much of the burden. And even with powerful farm organizations like the Farm Bureau on his side, he knows property tax cuts will be hard to pass.
There aren't that many of us out here anymore. We don't have very many votes.
If the farm economy turns around or if land prices start dropping, changes in property taxes could move to the back burner. But neither of those are likely in the short term, meaning farmers will push to keep their most valuable asset, their land, from becoming a financial burden. Grant Gerlach, Harvest Public Media.
Later today, we go to the eye of the fast casual storm, Colorado. Over the next few weeks, we'll present stories for this season of giving. There are almost 200 food banks in the U.S. that are part of the Feeding America network. Nationally, those organizations distribute 3 billion plus meals every year. Much of the food comes from the USDA's Emergency Food Assistance Program. Farmers donate food from their fields. Of course, there are food drives where individuals like you give canned and packaged goods. Then there are people like Phil Christensen, who donate food from their garden. Phil's entire garden, in fact, is dedicated to growing food for his local soup kitchen. But what happens when his garden doesn't produce at all? Lindsay Wright brings us a story of growing, giving, and grieving for a barren garden.
We'll be replacing that pretty soon. Here's a tiller.
I'm with Phil Christensen, and we're in his tool shed. Right now, he's showing me his rototiller. It's pretty important to him because it was his dad's. Before passing away, his dad used the machine for gardening, which is what Phil now does.
The rototiller's been running great for 34, 35 years, so we keep it running. It's good.
But when it comes to growing food, it's about more than your tools. Phil says a successful gardener has to have desire.
Somebody that's willing to get their hands dirty and jeans dirty and a little bit of determination.
Phil started planting in a 30 by 70 foot garden 3 years ago. And currently he donates most of what's produced to the Hobart Food Pantry, just a short 15 or so minute drive from the garden.
Yeah.
You're busy.
It's crazy right now, but this is good though. It's a good busy, good crazy.
Teresa Larimore is the executive director of the pantry. I visited during one of their big annual food drives. At this point in the year, they see lots of non-perishable donations. Teresa says summertime is one of her favorite times. That's when they get fresh produce from people like Phil.
When the fresh things are brought in, not only does it give us nutrition in the best of way, but it also brings in conversation and something that feels special.
Fresh donations like Phil's encourage Teresa to expand the facilities.
We needed something that when someone, say like Phil, was ready to bring us something and it was, say, Friday, but we're not giving out until Tuesday. I needed a place that could stay, you know, in the best kept shape. This took me about a year of grant writing to get this, is our walk-in cooler. So in here...
The Hobart Food Pantry feeds around 140 people every single week, and that's on the low side. So the pantry can't rely on people like Phil because gardeners never know how much harvest will come up. And we all know how Indiana weather can be.
The rivers across central Indiana will be rising across parts of the area as we get more and more rain. Here's the weather.
You're going to deal with a pretty good rain, so make sure those windshield wipers are working.
Record rainfall hit the state during June and July. Some parts of Indiana received more than 8 inches above their average precipitation. As a result, Phil's garden was completely washed out. If you've ever tried to grow your own food, you can probably relate.
They're taking a big risk with the weather. That's out of their control. It's out of my control. It's out of their control. And you learn that, what you've heard over the years can hit you one summer.
Phil lost pretty much everything this season, meaning he wasn't able to donate.
And it hurt me a little bit, and I just had to put it behind me and say, well, we just move on, wait till next year.
Back at Phil's garden, it's a beautiful day. The garden is just dirt, and there's nothing to dig up with the shovel. But one bad year isn't going to stop Phil from growing food.
I get a lot of enjoyment out of just working in the garden, spending time behind the tiller. Yeah, I can come over here and just forget everything for 2 or 3 hours at a time. I know there's a need there, and I'm not providing a whole lot, but what I provide helps somebody.
Oh, and that tiller? He'll drag it out of the shed again in the spring when it's time to plant his seeds. For Earth Eats, I'm Lindsay Wright.
That story was a result of a partnership with Indiana University's Media School. A special thanks to Sarah Neal Estes. You can see Lindsay Wright's photos of Phil Christensen and the Hobart Food Pantry at eartheats.org. Next week, giving the gift of a first-time homebrew kit. Quick trip to the kitchen right now, or I guess it's more a trip to the fireplace. A few weeks back, we cooked duck and pumpkins in the fireplace. This recipe was also from that amazing day of cooking with Daniel Orr in Columbus, Indiana. Here is a cheesy appetizer to put in front of your guests.
What I like to do is to take the brie and cut it in half, and that way it exposes that wonderful, rich, creamy interior. And then I can put it right back in these boxes and decorate it. I'm going to put a little bit of salt and pepper on it. And that's just going to kind of wake up those flavors a little bit. And then I've got wonderful Oregon hazelnuts. Okay, and we're just going to push those kind of down into the cheese. Next we'll do maybe a layer of the apricots. So we'll do a little bit of walnuts and some pine nuts around the outside. And then I'm going to finish by glazing this with a little bit of honey. And then we're going to take this to the fireplace and just let it kind of warm and get all gooey and delicious. Once you got, and you could do this a day or two ahead, have this in the fridge and just pull it out and either even just set it next to the fireplace and it's going to get warm. In France, they have something called raclette, which is another type of cheese that you have next to the fireplace and you scrape it off and you with potatoes. So it's a real old tradition. But I think it's a wonderful thing to have during the holidays.
In the second half today, more from the kitchen.
Yeah, and they'll get really, really crunchy. And the onions inside give them a savoriness, that lemon zest. So they become much more special than just a plain old grated hash brown.
Fancy latkes for Hanukkah. We have two recipes from the Jewish food tradition. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. You're with Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. Grabbing a quick meal doesn't just mean fast food. Now there are fast, casual options like Chipotle or Panera, restaurants that borrow ideas from both fast food and upscale sit-down restaurants. As Harvest Public Media's Luke Runyon reports, the fast casual boom is part demographics, part economics.
At a shopping center in Glendale, Colorado, LaQuadra Staples and her husband Jason are sitting down to lunch. The restaurant is new, a barbecue spot called Carve.
You know, today we're just out running errands, and so we just stopped in for a nice lunch.
Carve bills itself as fast casual barbecue. The interior is styled with exposed wood beams, chrome metal chairs, and stainless steel. Online reviews call it the Chipotle of barbecue, and it definitely gives off that vibe. It's quick, with brisket and sweet potatoes arranged on butcher paper and pushed down an assembly line. A meal runs $9 or $10.
It's my first time, so I kept it minimum.
I usually do like the whole fast casual thing, like when I'm at work on my lunch break, because they're quick, and the food's usually a couple of notches up from fast food.
Folks like the Staples are driving this push to fast casual dining. They're in their 30s, both professionals, working busy jobs with little time to cook at home. But when they get hungry, they're not pulling up to drive-through windows at fast food joints.
I graduated from culinary school, and I eat out more than I cook at home. It's kind of a shame, so...
Despite the higher price of a fast casual meal, enough people are thinking and eating like the Staples to make it more than a fleeting trend.
So they're looking for basically a full-service quality product in a McDonald's, you know, style efficiency.
That's Mitch Roth, the CEO of the restaurant group that owns Carve. Traditional sit-down restaurants struggled after the recession. So did fast food. But during the same time, fast casuals exploded and their foot traffic rose. Just from the Carve parking lot, you can see two other chains with expanding footprints, Tokyo Joe's and Modern Market.
I think with the number of young people that are moving to Denver, the active lifestyle in Denver, it promotes or it encourages restaurateurs to operate a certain way.
The millennials are the ones who are really pushing this.
Katie Sutton advises new fast casual chains for the consulting firm Food and Drink Resources.
And they are eating out 6-7 times a week. They want groovy, they want spicy, they want bold. And that's what these fast casuals aren't afraid of. They're putting the flavor into their food.
Sutton says fast casuals are now the hip startups of the restaurant world. And here's how it typically works. Young, ambitious chefs get out of culinary school, then team up with a business partner. They ditch the full-service experience to put more money into the ingredients while cutting costs on waitstaff. Eventually, the chef entrepreneur wants to expand.
And then some venture capitalist comes in and purchases you. And so that happens for a lot.
Hey, how you doing? Nice to meet you.
How's it going?
Good.
In suburban South Denver, workers at Mad Greens, a fast casual chain that serves up customized salads, are prepping for the lunch rush.
We cook almost everything from scratch.
Dan Long is a Mad Greens co-founder. The Colorado-based chain is beginning to stretch beyond the state's boundaries with restaurants in Arizona and planned openings in Texas. But when you're a restaurant chain that touts its locally sourced food, expansion is complicated.
What separates it from the fast food side of the equation is the quality and the freshness of the ingredients.
When Mad Greens opens a new store, they send people out to establish relationships with local farmers. Cooking from scratch, that takes time and some skill. And all that adds up to a more expensive salad.
It does get difficult as you get bigger and I think a lot of fast casuals are running into that.
But if it was easy and cheap, everyone would do it, even the fast food giants. Luke Runyon, Harvest Public Media.
In case you missed it, Harvest posted a really fun story celebrating Green Bean Casserole's 60th birthday. That story, along with a couple you heard today, posted at harvestpublicmedia.org. When Judy Wicks opened her restaurant, White Dog Cafe, in 1983 in Philadelphia, she'd never heard of fair trade or sustainability. She learned about these things as she went along, as she describes in her book, Good Morning, Beautiful Business. The decisions she made in those early days weren't informed by trends. It was about doing right by the people around her. As a small business owner, she saw firsthand how her choices affected her customers, her neighbors, and her employees. Like when she was deciding how much to pay entry-level dishwashers.
I was in the kitchen one time, and three young men who were making below the living wage happened to look up at me at once, and the light bulb went off in my head. And I thought, of course I want anyone who works, 40 hours a week full-time at the White Dog to be able to pay their rent and buy their food and their clothes and so on. So, of course, I want to pay a living wage.
A choice like that cut into the profits of the restaurant. But that was okay for Wicks. Her goal from the very beginning was to maximize relationships, not to maximize profits. White Dog also started offering local food purchased from area farmers in 1986. That was long before the food movement became a national craze.
And in doing so, I think I had a financially successful business because I really focused on the relationships with the employees and the customers and my suppliers and so on, and that ends up with long-term financial sustainability as well. And, to me, it's just about fairness, and it's about stopping the measurement of success by how much money we have and start measuring success by how healthy are our communities and how healthy is our natural environment.
She built relationships with local farmers that are mutually beneficial. She gives waste products from the kitchen to her growers, and they use it as fuel.
One of the things that our farmers are doing is heating the greenhouses with used fry oil from the restaurant. So this is an economical way to heat greenhouses in the winter, which really makes growing more vegetables possible because one of the challenges had been the cost of heat. But with free heat from the vegetable oil, the biodiesel, this has created more year-round farming under greenhouses.
Which in turn gets more local food on the menu more of the year. In my conversation with Judy, she talked a lot about balance, profits versus relationships, what you need versus what you want, and the balance of masculine and feminine energies in the world of food.
One of our farmers said that he feels that good farming is a balance between the masculine and the feminine, and he sees the masculine as being efficiency and the feminine as being nurturing. And the factory farming is kind of the worst example of masculine energy totally dominating. So that it's all about efficiency. It's all about, wringing every last penny out of the animals and the land and the workers and so on with almost no nurturing whatsoever. So we need to have that back in balance.
Judy Wicks is the founder of White Dog Cafe in Philadelphia, and she's also the recipient of the James Beard Foundation's Humanitarian of the Year back in 2005. Her book is Good Morning, Beautiful Business, The Unexpected Journey of an Activist Entrepreneur and Local Economy Pioneer. Hanukkah this year started last Sunday and goes until Monday, December 14th. The tradition is to cook foods in oil, like donuts or potato pancakes.
Latkes.
That's right. in Daniel Orr's kitchen, where flavor is the name of the game.
We've got some nice grated potatoes, and we're adding some eggs. Okay, now we're going to flavor this up. We're going to add some diced red onion. Something that Grandma might not have put in these, we're going to add a little lemon zest. Yeah, and they'll get really, really crunchy, and the onions inside give them a savoriness, that lemon zest. So they become much more special than just a plain old kind of a grated hash brown. Okay, we add a little bit of chopped thyme and rosemary, and we're going to finish it with some scallions and a little bit of rice flour. And we just want to have enough flour in there to pull it together so we can form little pancakes with it. Okay, we're going to season it with some salt and pepper. All right, I've got some nice hot oil on. Okay, and I'm just making little mounds of these in the pan. Once we get them in and they set, I'm just going to pat them down a little bit. What I like to do is to kind of pat the bottom of my spatula down into the oil and then to pat them out like that. And that way they won't stick to my spatula. And once they're crispy on the first side, we'll turn them over, and they just take a couple minutes to cook.
Don't forget to dab these latkes with paper towels to remove excess oil before you serve them. Oh, and that rice flour, he chose that as a gluten-free option, but you can use whatever flour you like. All right, now another dish that is often enjoyed around Rosh Hashanah.
This one is called tzimis. What it represents is kind of the sweet and sour of life. So what we have is a lot of different root vegetables that we're going to be adding some different ingredients to. I've got a pot going here. Now, there's several different ways you could do this. You could layer it in a baking dish and then put the liquids over it and let it slowly bake. But I'm usually a little bit more pressed for time than that. So we're just going to throw this all in a hot pan. Okay, I've got some orange juice. Now I'm going to throw in some sweet potatoes, some carrots. It's all going to kind of cook into one another and become kind of like a fruit compote. Now I'm adding some dried fruit. I'm using figs today and some dried apricots. Okay, now we're going to add fresh orange peel. We've got some honey, which is going to give us our sweetener. Okay, I'm going to add about a cup of water there, and we're just going to bring that up to a boil, cook it until everything's nice and tender, and that will be our tzimis.
Make a nice brisket or lamb to go with the tzimis. And the latkes, make sure you have some applesauce and sour cream on hand. You can bring these recipes up on your smartphone as you're cooking. Easy instructions and some photos to get your family excited about what's for dinner. We're at eartheats.org. Our crew is Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, Kate Griebel, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, Betsy Shepard, Kale Wilk, and everyone at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Fine day to be with you. Hope you'll come back next time. I'm Annie Corrigan.